Welcome to Space Coast September 26, 2009 meeting. Thank you all for coming. Could please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have a bunch of new members. We have in condominiums or associations, we have Ocean Royale Condominium Association, Ocean Gardens Townhouse Owners Association, Sable Palms Condominium Association, Laguna Vista Condominium Association, and Whitley Bay Condominium Association. We also have a number of businesses that have joined the association. We have a company called Aerial Photos over Brevard. We have Monroe's Mowing, Inc. Is anyone here from either? We have Global Gate Systems, Incorporated. True Green Lawn Care. Is True Green here? Okay, we have Worth and Company, Worthy and Company. Thank you for coming. Thank you for being a member. HD Construction Services and Competitive Hurricane Protection. And we have one individual new member, a Ms. Michelle Johnson. We have a short treasurer's report. Clay, do we have that available?
It will be short and sweet. We're proud to say that all our bills are paid. We're current. As of yesterday for this year, we're about $2,687 in the black. And we have nice reserves set aside in the money market account. So we're good to go for the foreseeable future.
Thank you. Regarding some legislation, just to bring you guys up to speed a little bit, we have started the legislative process a lot earlier this year than we have in the past. We're trying to simplify the process, which is quite interesting in its concept. We have a number of people working on some good legislation this year that we hope we can talk the representatives and the senators into actually following and not gumming up the works, as some of them have a tendency of doing, but we'll see what happens this year. But we just want to let you know that we're already diligently working quite hard on getting you some good legislation for the coming years. We have a couple of announcements. The next President's Forum will be October 10th at 10 o'clock, and Space Coast needs a couple of volunteers. We'd like to, if you can possibly, volunteer a few minutes a month. We need some people to make telephone calls to announce the meetings, and the more we get, the less, of course, calls get divided between the people. You're probably talking between 10 and tops 15 phone calls each a month. So if you'd like to do that and you want to either sign up, let either Virginia know or sign up at the desk, or you can email me directly and just give me the name and information, and I'll pass it along to Jackie, who unfortunately is on vacation this week, but I'll get her the information. Sure can. This meeting was not on a call list, okay? The next one is we're trying numerous different paths to follow to see where we're getting the most, because no matter where we go, we're finding that the attendance level has been dropping off, not just at our meetings, but at a number of other meetings and ventures that, you know, I go to and a couple of other people do go to. And we're trying to boost it up as much as we possibly can, so we're trying anything that works. Free candy. Free cookies. We'll try just about anything. All right? So if you can and you want to sign up with us via email, please send me the email. Let me know what it is, and I'll forward it to Jackie, and we'll get a crew together and give you the list of the people that we need to have called. All right? Thank you for that. We have, it's our pleasure today to have a current commissioner from Cocoa Beach here, Mr. Ken Griffin. Ken, where are you? He had a meeting and he had to leave. Okay. Well, we had a commissioner here. Today's program, we have Mr. Gary Polyakov from Becker and Polyakov and his son Ryan, who are authors and co-authors of the book New Neighborhoods. And I will tell you, what I have written here is, I read the book in 2.5 hours. It is absolutely phenomenal. And I've even recommended that the DVPR put it on their website as educational material, because anybody who's serving on a board of directors, if your residents read this book, and every new owner reads this book, it will probably cut down 75% of the nonsense that goes on in boards of directors. And the DBPR read their copy of the book, and they absolutely agree with us. So they have now listed it on as published material on the DBPR website. And I think it's going to save everybody a lot of aggravation. I've even recommended to them that they could find a way to give it away when they do license renewals. This way all your real estate brokers would get a copy, and all your managers and managing agents. So that's what I think of the book, and I hope if some of you have read it, you share the same views. If you haven't read it, you know they're on sale in the back. The price of the book is $13.47 per copy today. And if you're using checks, make the checks out to the New Neighborhoods Publishing, LLC. And if you bring them in the back, both Gary and Ryan will be happy to sign them for you as a personalized copy. At this point, I would love to turn the meeting over to Mr. Gary Polyakov and Ryan Polyakov for introducing his new book and speak a little something on the new book to bring you all up to speed. Gary? We need to wire you up.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay. You got the pocket?
Okay.
You need to put the rest in there. I got you do that. And sorry, pocket.
Okay. Very good.
Good morning. I truly want to thank Roger Kesselbach and Harry Charles, the President Emeritus of the Space Coast Community Association, for all of their support over the years. And I want to thank all of you. My column in Florida Today has run for quite a few years. And recently, the paper, unrelated to the column, cutting back on their expenses, had decided they were going to discontinue the column. Now, to put something into perspective, I don't know exactly how much it is because I, quite frankly, it's nominal. I'll turn it over to my law firm. I think it's something like $5 a column, they said. This is a nominal thing. And yet they said that they were cutting back because they were cutting back on their expenses. And someone said to me, they said it was costing them this enormous amount of money. And if so, I was trying to figure out where it was going, but it wasn't going to me. The phone calls were apparently overwhelming, that immediately the new executive manager who had made that decision was forced to retract the decision. I understand they didn't move it to Sunday, maybe to the business section, which may make it a little more difficult for some. But it's greatly appreciated on my part. I receive thousands of letters a year from across the state. The column appears in some 20 newspapers. It's really humanly impossible to be able to respond to all of them. But I do my best to randomly select a handful. And every time I'm on an airplane, traveling anywhere, I'm basically spending my time responding to the questions. So if I do not have a respond to your particular question, I apologize for not being able to do so. I'm humbled by the number of letters that I received. And quite frankly, it was because I wasn't able to in the number of letters that I received that we ended up writing, my son and I, New Neighborhoods. So many people wrote and said, when are you going to write a book? And actually, I am the author of a two-volume legal treatise that I wrote for lawyers. It's called Polyakov, The Law of Condominium Operations. And it's it covers the national scope and very detailed technical case citations. And I am also the co-author of a Florida Bar CLE manual. But neither of those books, in my opinion, were the types of materials that were really necessary to help those individuals who live in shared ownership communities. And when we talk about shared ownership communities, we are talking about condominiums, we're talking about cooperatives, and we're talking about planned developments that are governed by homeowner associations. And what they all have in common is the fact that they all are governed by a contractual constitution that those who buy into these communities agree to at the time they purchase. And these are mandatory membership associations. That is, as a condition of living in the community, you agree to give up certain rights and to be governed by these associations. And Roger and Harry, in their review of the book, which they placed on Amazon, which I greatly appreciate because those reviews are important, mentioned the fact that this is not a legal book. And I want to point out they're correct. This was not written to be a legal book. This was not written to be a parallel book to the excellent book that Pete Dunbar has out on Florida condominium law. This book was written to give you an overall view and understanding of the shared ownership concept. It's sort of like a primer so that those who buy into, who serve on the boards, who live under the regimes of shared ownership can understand exactly what are their rights, what are their responsibilities, and how the system works. And it's written for a national audience, so it is not time-dated. It's not something that has to be rewritten every year, every time there's a change in the law. The shared ownership concept actually traces its roots back to ancient Roman times. It actually was mentioned in the Napoleonic codes. In our book, we use the analogy to the Pueblos in Taos, New Mexico, where people shared common grounds inside of caves that they lived in. The concept has not really changed that dramatically in terms of what it is to live in a small community and share certain amenities in common. But my writings, as I've indicated, were primarily for lawyers. And I needed someone to be able to help translate, to synthesize at 37 years that I worked in the trenches, understanding that when I started in this field, the concept had come in from Europe by way of Puerto Rico. It wasn't an American concept. It came through the Florida in 1963 by way of Puerto Rico. And we evolved the law. We had to draft statutory law. We had to go into the courts and argue cases where we have precedent to follow, to understand how it would be interpreted. But it was all very legalese. And I was fortunate to have one of my sons. I'm blessed in having two sons, both who I work with, one in my law firm, one who I'm working with in the authorship of this book, to translate that legalese into conversational English so that it could be easy reading, understandable. In fact, that is the thing that has been noted the most. New Neighborhoods has, and of course this fluctuates, so there's been many days that it has appeared as the number one best-selling book on the Amazon real estate list of books. And that's largely because of individuals such as yourself who have given us such great support. What I thought I would do this morning is to just do an overview of some of the concepts of shared ownership, talk to you a little bit about some of the things we point out in the book. My son is going to talk to you about what is really the new hot topic in this field. Next week is Be a Good Neighbor. We actually have that as a national thing. I was on Fox News. Tomorrow he's going to be on as a CBS national news. It's being taped tomorrow for playing. There are 400 stations across the nation, and he'll be speaking about what it means to be neighborly when you're living in close confines that you do in a shared ownership community. I think it's also of some value to understand how this concept has grown exponentially across this country. When I started out of law school, I graduated in 1969. The first Condominium Act was written into Florida in 1963. And that was basically what we refer to as an enabling statute. It strictly provided or recognized the concept of condominium ownership. It was totally void of any consumerism. There were no disclosures. There were no rights of owners to take control over and operate their own associations. The common scheme used in those days where you would buy a home in one of these communities, be it a planned development or a condominium, and as a condition of buying that home, you were obligated to enter into a lease for recreational amenities, and there was no independent property management. The developer, at the same time he created the community, also entered into long-term 50-year or 99-year contracts to manage the communities. It wasn't until a case that I and my partner argued in the court, a case called Miller versus Granadas, argued in the federal court where we attacked these tying agreements as being a violation of the Sherman and the Clayton Act, that it broke apart that arrangement and opened the field for independent property managers. But from those early days, and if we look back 10, 15, 20 years ago, there were probably less than 30,000 of these communities in the entirety of the United States. Today there are now 300,000 associations, community associations in the United States. Let's put that into perspective. In the entirety of this country, there are only 85,000 governmental entities. And I'm talking about the municipalities, I'm talking about state government, I'm talking about the federal government. 85,000 governmental entities, and yet today there are over 300,000 community associations in the United States. And those associations are responsible for the operation of homes in which reside 24.5 million people in this country. That's over 60 million individuals. One in every 20 individuals in this country today live in a community governed by a mandatory membership association. And they spend in their budgets close to $41 billion a year. Something I'm going to talk about a little later, because obviously one of the big crises we're facing today is the problem of collecting the monies necessary to operate. But $41 billion, and there's an additional $35 billion that are held in reserve accounts. There are now 60,000 individuals who hold themselves out as independent professional managers. Again, back when I started, there was no such concept as an independent professional manager for shared ownership communities, and today there are over 60,000. And of course, here in the state of Florida, where they're licensed as licensed CAM managers. When you really stop to think about it, and people like to make this very complex, and that's why I said we've really worked hard in this book, and in very small number of pages. I don't remember, is it 240 pages or so, to really tell it all. It's small in the context. It's not, purposely didn't want to write a 400 or 500 page book. Roger said he was able to read it over in 3 hours, but in those 3 hours, I think he gave a very good understanding of how the whole concept all fits together. If you really think about it, the association only exists to do three things. It exists to maintain and operate the shared ownership community. It exists to maintain the property values. That's an important aspect of the association. That association and its board have a fiduciary responsibility to ensure you that when you invest, which is one of the largest investments we all make in our lifetime, in our homes, that money is going to, if it doesn't appreciate, it, at least it's not going to depreciate. And unfortunately, we have communities across the state right now where there's actually a significant depreciation in value of units, where people are not only upside down in their mortgages, but they're also upside down in terms of the valuation of their property. And the third thing that those associations exist for is to enforce the covenants, conditions, and restrictions, the rules and regulations that the individuals agree to at the time they purchase. One of the hallmarks of shared ownership is that you agree at the time you buy into these communities to give up certain rights that would be normally inherent in single-family detached ownership, and it's done for the good of the community. But those agreements are not just, well, you know, I'll think about it if and when the time comes. It's an agreement that you've agreed to be bound by, and so that is the third leg of the responsibility of the stool of the shared ownership association, the community association. Those three: maintain the community, enforce the covenants and restrictions, and to protect the values of your property. For those of you who serve on boards of directors, I like to always have one, at least one board. Humor, a man goes to the doctor, and the doctor examines him, and he says, you know, I'm sorry, I have some bad news for you. He says, well, what's that? He says, well, unfortunately, you have a medical condition, and then I don't think you have much more than 6 months to live. And the doctor, the man looks at the doctor, and he says, you know, that's really terrible. He says, what would you suggest I do? The doctor says, do you live in a shared ownership community? And the man said, no, as a matter of fact, I live in a single-family detached house. He says, well, if I were you, I'd buy a condominium. And then I would run and get elected to the board. The man says, well, I just don't quite understand it. Here you are, you're telling me I only have 6 months to live, but you want me to run out and buy me a condominium? You want me to run to the board, get on the board? Why in the world would I want to do that with the last 6 months of my life? And the doctor said, because it will be the longest 6 months of your life. Now, I told you what is the responsibilities of the association. What about the owners? There really is only three responsibilities that a unit owner has. One is to pay their share of the common expenses and to recognize the fact that they are owners and not tenants. This is combined together. The biggest problems we have in this field today is the fact that too many people buy into shared ownership communities with the expectation that when they buy and are told the monthly maintenance payment is X amount of dollars, that it's like a mortgage, and that that means that forever that is the amount of money that they're going to pay each month. But we know in reality that that is not the truth. It's not the truth for a number of reasons. First of all, because as a owner, you're going to be responsible for not only paying for your share of the common expenses, but if you have other owners in the community who, for financial reasons, be it that their units are being foreclosed, they're having economic crises, that is called bad debt on the books of the association. And someone has to pick up that shortfall, because I've never seen, and I can understand why, I've just never seen a situation where, be it the landscape maintenance company, the pool company, the insurance company, even the lawyers, others who are the servicing the communities, that they go to the association president or manager and say, how many of your owners are not paying their assessments this month? And the manager says, well, we got about 10 to 15% delinquency. And the vendor says, all right, we're going to cut back on those expenses 15% this month. We're not, in other words, you don't have to pay it. It doesn't work that way. I'm seeing for the first time in the history of my involvement in this field, and as I said, it dates back to nearly the inception. I've written letters just Wednesday of this week. I sent a letter to the President of the United States, to the Governor of the State of Florida, to every single member of the Florida delegation, to every single member of the Florida House and the Florida Senate. And in it, I wrote about a column that I published that you might have read a few issues ago about this crisis that we're having in terms of associations where the amount of delinquencies have risen to the point where they've actually had their water or their dumpsters, their trash removal, or their services curtailed or cut off entirely. When that happens, you're not only penalizing the individuals who aren't paying, you're affecting the valuations of the property of every owner. And this problem is being compounded by, quite frankly, ridiculous, I'll call it idiotic, regulations that are now being imposed by some of our federal agencies. Do you know that HUD now, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac now have lending guidelines that say regardless of the financial stability of individuals who are buying into the community, if there are more than 15% delinquencies in the community, we're not going to approve the loans. We have banks that are redlining communities. That is, they're saying the amount of delinquencies within a defined geographical area or the number of foreclosures are so great we no longer are making loans into condominium communities. And then on top of that, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac adopts new lending guidelines that say if your association is engaged in litigation designed to ensure that your buildings meet structural requirements and code requirements, that is standard warranty litigation. And I'm not making this up. One agency says it has to relate to warranty litigation. The other agency says any litigation. Now, any litigation could mean a suit you filed to collect delinquent assessments. It could be a suit you filed to enforce the covenants and restrictions. They're saying that if your association is being sued and you're forced to defend that action, someone slips and falls on the common areas, you're enforcing a covenant, they are not going to approve a loan for your community. Now, how can we restore the economic viability of these communities that are under this economic stress if we are now passing laws that are derailing efforts to be able to recover? The other problem that I wrote about and I attached to my email, blasted to all of those individuals, copies of newspaper articles. So this wasn't just Derek Polyakov's column. These were newspaper articles from the Wall Street Journal, from the New York Times, from the Miami Herald, from papers all over the state. And one of the articles from the Miami Herald is something I never thought I'd ever see in this field. Do you know that there are, in South Florida, over 5 associations in the last few months have filed bankruptcy? I'm not talking about developers who are upside down on their developments and are construction lenders are seeking to take over and they're fine. I'm talking about the operating associations are collecting so little money from their owners that in order to keep the creditors at bay, 5 associations have filed bankruptcy to reorganize. So in these letters that I sent out, I point out one of the real flaws in the way the process is currently working. And that is that we're allowing the lenders, now think about this, what is the collateral for the loans that the lenders made to individual unit owners? It's not just the unit. It's the whole ball of wax. It's the entire lifestyle and amenities of your community. It's the clubhouse. It's the golf courses. It's the walkways and the way and appearance of your community. That's what's going to maintain the value. So how are you going to be able to do that if the lenders are not required to contribute the share of the common expenses during the process before they take title to the unit? And therein is part of the problem. Lenders that are foreclosing, and you know this from experience, they're not taking title to the units. They file their foreclosure action, they get their judgments, and they sit on them until they can get a buyer, because they know what we all know, and namely is once you actually take physical title to the unit, you become a unit owner and you're responsible for your share of the common expenses. So the non-defaulting unit owners are being forced to cover the collateral for the banks that are receiving billions of dollars in our taxpayer dollars to bail out the banks, but they're not paying their share of the common expenses across this country on shared ownership communities, and that's a fact. And individuals who are upside down on their mortgages, they passed a new law, the Homeowner Affordability Act. I'm not opposed to the law. What I'm opposed to is the fact that while the banks are renegotiating the monies that are the owed to the lenders, shouldn't there be a requirement as a condition of those renegotiations that they bring their assessments, their associations current, so that the other owners in the community that are being forced to pick up the bad debt aren't? When we have a casualty in this state, I've got a situation right now, and I don't know if you have it here, and I may have mentioned this in the past. We have a 40-year rule in Miami-Dade and Broward County that says that every 40 years, a building inspector comes out and he examines your building from top to bottom. He's examining it to determine whether or not it's safe, sound, and meets all the current code requirements. If it doesn't, you're required to bring the building up to current code standards. So we have buildings where they're coming out and they're citing the buildings for all kinds of code deficiencies. But where are they supposed to get the money? They have this crisis of non-payment. They have the banks telling them, well, we're not going to approve new buyers because you have too many delinquencies or you're in litigation over some of these things. So I also recommended in the letter that we open the Small Business Administration loans that we have available to community associations following casualties, so that associations that are in this crisis can get low-interest loans. We're not talking about bailouts. We're not talking about gifts. We're talking about low-interest loans so that we can stabilize and restore the economic viability of communities that house one in every five Americans. That's how significant this problem is across the country. Now, I could use your help in this, and I can use your help by when those state representatives and the state senators and your congressmen and senators knock on your doors, which they do because they like coming where there is a collection of a lot of people living together, and they're going to say, we want your vote. And I want you to ask them, well, what have you done about this problem? And I can tell you, sitting here right now today, there's not a single member of the Congress, Democrat or Republican, who has spoken out on this issue and tried to find a solution to it. And I can tell you that last year, the Space Coast Community Association worked its tail off in Tallahassee, along with others, to write legislation that would have forced lenders to expedite the foreclosure process and or pay their share of the common expenses. And your state reps and your state senators, no matter what they tell you, wouldn't even bring the darn bill up for a vote in the Senate to get it passed. That's horrendous. If you're down there, and if you're serving on your boards, if you're in the trenches as I am every day, this bothers me. This bothers me because everyone likes, and some of the things that are being passed, they pass a bill that says that if you want to run for the board of directors, you have to sign a certificate saying that you basically have a law degree. I'm going to tell you something, friends. I think I know as much about the Condominium and Homeowner Association Acts of the state as anyone in this state. I teach as an adjunct law professor. I've taught for over 30 years. Last year I was named adjunct law professor of the year. One of the members of the audience came up at the beginning and asked me a statutory section number, and I said, honestly, I don't remember the exact statute number. If I don't know the exact statute number, how can they expect people who are volunteers on boards to be able to recite verse and page number? And that's what the law currently says, just to qualify to serve on the board of your condominium. For free. That's right. For free. It's ridiculous. So they have time to pass this type of legislation, all right, and some of the other things that are muddying up the water and to dissuade people from running from the board, and yet they don't even have time. And one of the things I was going to work on in the next week or two is I'm going to go through last sessions of the legislature and make a list of some of the bills that were passed last year, and I don't mean just in condo and homeowner association. And give you some idea of what they thought was important enough to pass, but this issue that affects 5 million people in this state, forget the nation, 5 million people in this state are affected by this, and they couldn't even find the time to get it voted on during the 60 days of the legislative session. Well, we're going to make darn sure this year that that doesn't happen. Yes, I did. Well, this letter just went out this past week, and absolutely we'd be happy to. If you go to our website, we have it. It's called Community Association Leadership Lobby, and you can click on there, and it will take you directly to your state senators and to your state reps, and we'll do that. And we'll put a form letter to say enough is enough, time to act. But I especially want you to do is when whoever they are, when they knock on your doors this year, saying, you know, I'm running for re-election, ask them the question, well, what did you do to help us alleviate this problem? This is a problem that we need to deal with. Now, I know I went off on a tangent about that. First thing I know I was talking to you about was the obligations of owners are to timely pay their share of the common expenses. But that's not being done. And that's creating a problem. The other thing that owners are required to do is to abide by the covenant's conditions and restrictions that they agreed to at the time they purchased their units. You'd be surprised how many people, listen, who reads them, right? Who reads them? I read them too, but, you know, and then they move into communities and they assume that, and I've had this actually happen, where they move into a housing for older person community that says you have to have at least one person 55 years of age or over, no children below the age of 18, young couple moves in, under the 20%, you're allowed to have 20% of the people who don't fall in that category. Woman gets pregnant, she has a baby. Immediately, well, I didn't really think you really meant it. Or you move into a community that says no pets. And now we know there's a whole body of law that has evolved to deal with under the fair housing laws where you have to make accommodations for trained service animals. And I don't have a problem with that, with individuals that have hearing and sight impairments and they have trained animals. Although there is one group that is now promoting, and I don't make this up, look on the web, go on the internet, there's a group that now promotes is a trained service animal, miniature horses. And I actually saw on a news show the other day on television someone riding a miniature horse who has a handicap in a supermarket. So there may be a miniature horse coming to your community. The bigger problem we deal with is what is called emotional support animals. And we deal with this on a daily basis. And what I trademarked the word, I wrote an article called Prescription Pets, because it used to be, if you lived in a shared ownership community, the first color you saw when you pulled into the community wasn't the beige colors of the building, but rather the blue stickers that hung from the windshield. If everyone had a handicap parking sticker. And I'm not saying this facetiously. Every doctor would write a letter for a handicap parking. But now they have these pre-prepared form letters. You can go on the web. There are a number of organizations that have letters that say just fill in the blank. To prescribe a pet for an individual who suffers from anxieties and depressions and rheumatoid arthritis or recovering from illness or just plain loneliness. I'm going to read you a letter in a little while that I actually received from an owner that where he said that the reason he needed to have a parrot, was because he injured his arm and he needed the parrot as a for rehabilitative purposes. Okay. The other thing that you need to do, and my son's sitting there saying, "Well, Dad, don't use up all my time, Ryan. We have plenty of time. Don't worry." He's going to talk to you about something very important, as I said, about being neighborly. The other thing that you need to do is not use your unit. So I've already said to you, just quick summary, you're supposed to pay your assessment, you abide by the covenants or restrictions. And the third thing is all we're asking unit owners to do is to avoid using a unit in a manner that disturbs other unit owners and denies them the quiet use of their property. In other words, you cannot use your unit in a manner that creates a nuisance that denies the peaceful use and possession of their unit. Well, let's face it, when you live in close confines with others, there are certain natural human interactions that are going to occur, which starts off by saying, and one of the things that I talk about in the book, is that Shared ownership is not for everyone. If you don't like living in situations where others are telling you what rules need to be followed, and you cannot, you're overly sensitive to sights and sounds, please choose some other form of ownership, because if you live in a shared ownership community in close confines, I can guarantee you, you will know what your neighbor is cooking and every evening. I may have told you this. I have a, from my other son, my son Ryan's expecting their first child in the next week or two. I have another son who has, one of my grandsons, 5 years old. And we have a beach condo, and we were walking down the hall of the condominium heading towards our unit, and we passed the unit, and my 5-year-old grandson says to me, he says, "What's that?" I said, "Someone's cooking." He said to me, "Well, I don't like that smell." I said, "Join the bandwagon. That's the fact of shared ownerships." And nowadays, particularly as we become a more culturally diverse community, you have people who are cooking food styles from all over the world, and some foods simmer on the oven, and those smells are going to penetrate between the walls. And you also have the issues of cigarettes and cigars. I've had to deal with situations where individuals sit out on their balconies, and if they're really annoyed at their neighbors, they blow the smoke upstairs. The next book, not in this one, because I don't have time for all the stories to it, but I actually had a situation where one owner who lived above, he kept flushing the toilet because of the sound was bothering his neighbor, kept complaining. So the other neighbors would go out on the balcony blowing the cigar smoke upstairs. You know, sometimes. There's an actual case where the courts are now starting to hold that if the volume of smoke is such to create a nuisance, that they will enjoin the cigarette smoking even inside the confines of your own private unit. Several cases on that now, particularly as we become more sensitive to the health impact that cigarette has on secondhand smoking. The other thing you have to learn to deal with in shared ownership communities, of course, is sounds. Don't you know what TV station? You don't need Nielsen ratings. Don't you know what your neighbor's listening to many evenings? You hear the TV, you hear the radio, you hear the record player. I might say, now, this is the reality of living in close contact. They do not build those separation walls out of concrete and sound insulation, and sound penetrates through those openings for the electrical outlets and through the air conditioning ducts and under the doors. And, of course, the people who, you know, if you're fortunate, you have a neighbor who's an artist, because it's very rare that you really hear the sound of the paint going on the canvas. But what if you have your next-door neighbor who feels that even though it's 40 years later, they still need to practice their trumpet every night or the piano, and quite frankly, they're not that good. That's why they keep practicing. And sights. Where is Fleming Island? Does anyone know? There's a case going on in Fleming Island right now. There's a guy up there who has an alligator in his garden. It's not a real alligator, it's the statue of an alligator. He's a Gator fan. And for every Florida game, he decorates this gator. The neighbors feel it's an eyesore. One person's artistic views are not necessarily shared by others. Someone sees a statue of David and they want to put a fig leaf upon it. I had a letter the other day. I wrote it in a column. I don't know if you remember, where one woman wrote in. She was embarrassed by the Brazilian bikinis being worn by the young girls at the swimming pool. Maybe it was the older women wearing them that was bothering her. I don't remember which it was. Sights and sounds. These are all part and parcel of shared ownership, and we talk about this extensively in New Neighborhoods. Now, with that understanding, and the last words in the book are the most important. With all that's said in the book, the last words in the book are the most important. And I'm going to tell you what they are in turning the mic over to my son, Ryan. And after he speaks, I'm going to come back and I'm going to tell you a story of a fellow up in Jacksonville whose covenants you won't really believe. The last words in the book are, be neighborly. And with that, I'd like to introduce my son, Ryan, co-author of New Neighborhoods. Yes, we have plenty of time. I was told that we're going to speak for another 30 minutes or so, and then we'll take all the questions you want. And then afterwards, I'll be in the back signing books for anyone who would like.
If you could repeat the question, also. And put this in the pocket.
That's perfect. Okay, it's all good. All right.
Hold on. When I point to you, Derek.
All right, thank you all very much. First of all, I want to thank everyone for having us. Dad and I both enjoy speaking on this topic quite a bit. I actually find this entertaining to chat with people about condo issues. Of course, Dad got on a roll, took a couple of things that I was going to talk about, so I have to adjust on the fly a little bit here. Before I start what I was going to talk about, I thought y'all would be interested in this one story. I actually served for 3 years as the president of my condominium, which is a very large association in South Florida. Our budget is over $4.5 million. It's a sizable operation. I stepped down recently to the vice president position and actually simply switched with our vice president, and she became the president largely because I have a baby due in 2 weeks. I knew that was going to be extremely time-consuming. We have the book coming out, which was exciting and also very time-consuming. I still find myself doing about the same job as vice president as I did as president, but I think that happens. This was the interesting story. My father was talking about prescription pets. People getting notes from their doctors and for emotional support animals. We had a gentleman in my condo send in a request to the board for a medical pet exemption, and we had granted one recently, which was on the fringe, but she did everything that she needed to do, and you know, what are you going to really argue with it? You know you're inviting a lawsuit. But in this case, what the guy did was he gave us a certification for his pet as a service animal, but when we looked into it, the certification was from an online company where you can simply register your pet as a service animal. So he handed us this form, which he had gotten online, had nothing to do with any particular training of the animal, and then said, my medical problem is private. I don't really want to discuss it with you, so this should be enough. Of course, we said no. Thank you very much, but no. But those are the kind of things where people really do assume that's okay and that's enough to get through the rules. One of the most interesting things to me, you know, I think everyone, when you're growing up, you want to find yourself and maybe not be exactly like your parents or exactly like your father. And I find myself 37 years into life realizing that, well, intellectually, we actually find certain things similarly intellectually stimulating. I actually like this stuff. I find it fascinating, and maybe it's because I grew up with it, maybe it's genetic. But I love this idea of the history of where shared ownership communities came from and how that really has affected both the way our neighborhoods operate and civic responsibility. That's really the big issue, civic responsibility. I have, tomorrow morning, I'm doing an interview for CBS News Radio, which will run
500 some odd stations around the country on Monday. And the issues that these people want to talk to me about, and I just did an interview for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette on similar issues, was the question of being neighborly and civic responsibility in an SOC world. You know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, people lived in fairly homogenous enclaves. You know, people of similar economic means and similar social backgrounds and similar racial backgrounds, similar religious backgrounds, all tended to live together. And they all had, you know, yeah, sure, some of the foods were smelly, but they were your smelly foods. And if you lived in a German community, you were used to the smell of sauerkraut cooking. Or I had a German friend in law school, and I walked into his house one day, and the whole place, I mean, to me, the smell was so strong, and he was cooking something with sauerkraut on the oven. It was just an amazing scent to me. But to him and his family, that was common. That's what they had. And there's a million other foods exactly like that. People were used to the way they lived that way. And in the 70s, when condominiums especially and then homeowners associations became popularized, they were originally sold, again, to discrete groups of people. They were offered to retirees for an adult lifestyle, all similar types of people with similar lifestyles. There were communities where they were marketed to singles who wanted an active lifestyle, let's say in a golf community, for example. It's all pretty similar. What has happened, however, is that the structure of shared ownership and this sort of democratic sub-government has proven to be very effective. And it's proven to be effective in managing municipal-style services that traditionally had been managed by cities, now are increasingly being managed by these community associations. And these days, when you go to buy a house, it's not as if, well, I'm thinking of buying a house, maybe I'll buy a house in some sort of specific HOA, or maybe I'll buy an apartment in some sort of specific condo. That's not really how it is anymore, especially in Florida. If you're going to buy property, you have a really good chance of buying property in a shared ownership community. And by the way, we call it shared ownership community in the book. We coined that term because we feel it's a little more explanatory. You know, the original term is common interest ownership community, but you say to an average person, well, what is common interest ownership? That's a legal term. So we call it shared ownership. And that's something everyone can kind of understand. You share ownership with your neighbors. So these days, you have people from all walks of life, different religions, different backgrounds, different socioeconomic backgrounds, certainly different age ranges. I mean, I was president of my condominium association. I'm 37 years old, and I have the big mutton chops. I'm not exactly super conservative traditional, but we have people in my community who are in their 70s and 80s who all voted for me and may have a little bit of different backgrounds, but I go out to dinner with these people. I mean, we're friendly. It's a very, you know, different societal sort of background. The real change that this has brought, however, and what people don't understand, is back in the early days of suburbs in the 50s and 60s, people started moving out to the suburbs. What did it mean to be a good neighbor? As my father brought up, next week, I believe it's Thursday or Friday, is National Good Neighbor Day. It's the 39th anniversary of National Good Neighbor Day. So I wrote an article on the issue, which I won't go into every point here. It's the top five things you need to do to be neighborly in an SOC world, and I'm going to touch on some of it. But what's really interesting, I think, to us here is how these issues involve civic responsibility. You know, people get involved in these communities. They don't get involved in these communities necessarily by choice. It's not necessarily a situation where they're saying, I'd like to live in a shared ownership community. What they're doing is looking for a home. They find a home that they like. They don't really think about the fact that it's a shared ownership community. They buy it, and then they wonder. you know, they get into it and they're like, what is going on here? Why are there rules I have to follow? Why did my maintenance just go up? Why can't these people just leave me alone? It's a very difficult educational problem. And that's one of the big reasons we wrote the book, is to try to educate ordinary people around the country about what it means to be in a shared ownership community. And one of the main things that it really does mean, getting back to what I was saying, 50 years ago, being a neighbor in your community, you bring over a pie when your neighbors move in, you're friendly, you say hello, maybe you share things, you talk over the fence, you loan your lawnmower. That's being a good neighbor, you know, years and years ago. Being a good neighbor today is a lot more involved than that, and the first aspect of it to me is increased civic responsibility, volunteerism, getting involved in the communities. It's no longer okay to simply live in your home and think that you're being a good neighbor to all of the people you share ownership with if you sit there, do nothing, let them manage everything, let the board run everything, except for the one meeting you show up to once a year to complain about the one thing that's on your mind to complain about. There's, in our community, I live in a community of 240 units, and the board for the last 3.5 years has been exactly the same. We've never had a board member run a post, ever. And this isn't because they love us. I know they don't love us because I've heard the comments. I actually had a guy come up to me. This was a funny one. I had a guy come up to me at a grievance committee meeting. And I was just there observing. And he said, is anyone from the board here? Unfortunately, that was me. So I said, yeah, that's me. And he said, hi. He said, I'm so-and-so. Here's my situation. I have this great renter in my unit. They're wonderful. They pay on time. But they want to bring a pet into the unit. And I really was just wondering if you would do me the favor of making an exception for me and letting them bring it, you know. And, of course, anyone who's involved with their association knows that that's not legal. At a very basic level, it's selective enforcement. You can't just say, okay, you seem like a nice guy, you have a good renter, you know, bring in your pet. So I tried to nicely say to him, I'm sorry, that's really not something we can do. Before 4 words are out of my mouth, he says, you know what, you're exactly like everybody says you are. All you do is say no, no, no to everything. Well, I'm not talking to you anymore. I'm done with you. And he walks away. He's done. So when I thought in my head, I'm thinking, well, first of all, I'm thinking two things. First of all, people really sit around and talk about me. I mean, I don't think I'm that interesting a person that they sit around chatting about me at the pool. But the second thing that came up is when they sit around talking to me, that's really what they think of me, is that I say no, no, no to everything. I mean, there's certainly some community in my community that does think that. When you're a board member, you learn to be thick-skinned. You can't worry about all these people who are uneducated about the issues and don't understand what your legal responsibilities are and what your fiduciary duty to the association is. And that's something, as a board member, I take very seriously. And most board members who are serious about their jobs that I talk to understand that responsibility and take it quite seriously. So in the modern world, I know in my association, we're dying for people to chip in and help us out, people to serve on the finance committee to help us with the budget, people to help with social events, people to help with buildings and grounds issues. And the board members, it is, as someone mentioned before when my father was speaking, it is a completely unpaid, volunteer, sometimes nearly full-time job that, you know, nobody, unfortunately, and this is the other issue, we're not specifically trained for. You know, condominium associations, homeowners associations, as another side, when I did this interview for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, just ran Friday, it just goes to show, don't believe what you read in the papers in general. I know a lot of reporters. I was in the PR industry. I know how it works. But when they put the title of the book next to HOA in their attempt to define it, they defined HOA as high occupancy apartments. Frankly, I'm not even sure what a high occupancy apartment. I've never heard that term. I mean, I had given this reporter the website. I told her what the book was about, but they don't work that hard at that. You know, nice person, but they don't work so hard to figure out the facts. But in condos and HOAs and co-ops, they are businesses. They're not-for-profit businesses in most cases, but they're businesses, and they require board members, ideally with business acumen. They require people who can read the budgets and read the financial statements and understand what they're looking at. They require people that can look at a contract and say, this is a bad term. This is an onerous term. But how often do we really have that in our communities? It's hard enough to find people who are willing to volunteer that time. And this is in the modern world, and this is what I'm trying to explain to reporters when I talk to them, and really trying to get the word out that now that we're in a situation where 20% of the country lives in shared ownership communities, it is time for people to understand that part of being a good neighbor is the civic responsibility to chip in, volunteer when appropriate, help out in your community when appropriate. This is what it takes to be a good neighbor now. It's not just, you know, loaning your lawnmower to a neighbor. It's getting involved in the community to help to operate the investment that you've made with all of your neighbors. And, you know, just to illustrate how difficult that really is, another analogy that I sometimes use. If I said to the people in this room, go out and buy a car with your best friend. A lot of people, when I say that to you, they like shudder. Because, all right, so it's your best friend. You get along pretty well with your best friend. But you know, even with your best friend, questions of how do you maintain it? How do you operate it? When do you make repairs? When do you do maintenance? Who uses it when? Those are major issues that have to be dealt with, and it's hard with a best friend. Now, instead of that, what if I said to you, I want you to go out and buy property, probably the largest investment you're ever likely to make in your life, with 200 strangers, and share that investment with them? Well, that's ludicrous to most people, but that is what a shared ownership community is. Now, some people may ask the question, well, why bother to have shared ownership communities? There are people, and we actually, on the web, we just read a kind of a funny review from a guy in Arizona who he reviewed the book, but basically what the review of the book says is, they wrote this book, but what they don't tell you in the book is how awful and evil HOAs and shared ownership communities are. They just talk about good things. They don't talk about how terribly disgusting they are. Well, we don't believe that. I mean, I certainly don't believe that, even with all the difficulty of serving on my board. And I know my father doesn't believe it after 37 years of practicing in the industry. SOCs, shared ownership communities, do very good things. Times are tough right now. Lots of financial problems. Municipalities are huge bureaucracies. They don't have money anymore. They don't have the ability to provide the level of services that a lot of us want in our homes. They don't do the level of tree trimming. They don't do the level of maintenance. They don't do the level of garbage collection. We have been able to shift, through shared ownership communities, a lot of municipal functions to smaller communities of people who, by working together, can manage those services. That's a good thing. And really, that's why, to me, if I'm saying, do I want to live in a condo or an HOA, even knowing everything I know? Absolutely. Absolutely. When it's time for me to move out of my condo into a larger home, I would love to be in a good HOA. But you can be darn sure that I'm going to check the things that I talk about in the book that we know are important to know. Are they collecting reserves? How is their board operated? What is their board like? Talk to people in the community and say, do they sit around screaming at each other for 2 hours a month? And, you know, or do they get along? When I was president of my association, knowing what I knew after all these years of growing up with my father and hearing the nightmare stories, and we talk about some of them in the book. One of my all-time favorites is the story of two older gentlemen in their 70s or 80s who got so upset at each other at a board meeting that they started sword fighting each other with their umbrellas that they had brought in from the... I mean, it's just fanciful. It really does drive people to fanciful levels. But in my board meetings, I was very, very careful to not let things get out of hand. And if that meant saying to a person, what you are doing now is not acceptable and I won't tolerate it, I did that. And it's important for board presidents or whoever's running the meeting to do that. Keep control of your meetings and make sure that if people start screaming at each other, you nicely ask them to tone it down and be productive. Another aspect, and this was something that my father sort of talked about, the new reality of shared ownership communities, as I had mentioned, is that they're multicultural. And I talked about the sauerkraut thing. Well, one of the things I talk about in the article is, you know, someone will say who lives in a shared ownership community, I'm having a terrible problem. My neighbor makes curry every night, and I can't stand the smell of curry. It's so strong. Well, one of the things I mentioned is, well, okay, that's legitimate, but you have to recognize that when you're cooking fish or when you're cooking sauerkraut or when you're cooking stuffed cabbage, I have a lot of Russian people in my building and they cook a lot of cabbage. And every time you walk on the elevator, I know it's cabbage night. That's part of the deal. When you're living, especially in a condo where it's, you know, a high-rise building, that's part of life these days. That's part of life in the 2000s. You're living in a multicultural community. What I suggest as a solution to that, and this is helpful too for, you know, board members, if someone comes to you and says, my neighbor is cooking curry every night, you have to stop them. Well, why don't you just go over to your neighbor's house, knock on the door, and say, hey, you know, that's a very unusual smell. What is it that you're cooking? Be friendly. A lot of times someone would say, actually, I'm making curry. It's my family's favorite dish. Would you like to try some? Maybe you do try some. Maybe you hate it. Maybe you like it. It doesn't matter, but you try it. You be polite. Maybe you invite them over for your sauerkraut one night, and you say to the neighbor, you know what? I know some of the things I cook smell really strong, too. This curry smells really strong also. Do you think it would be possible to crack a window open when you're cooking? I, of course, understand you're cooking. You have to cook for your family. I don't want either of us to knock the other one out with our cooking. There are ways to handle these things. Harry Charles gave me an article that he wrote a few minutes before this meeting, and I was flipping through it. And it was interesting. Something he says in his article is exactly the same thing that I said in my New Neighbor article that I wrote independently 3 weeks ago. And what he says is that 95% of people don't want conflict. And I agree with him 100%. The vast majority of people, you know, even people who react to things in an angry manner or a, you know, in a semi-aggressive manner, it's not necessarily because they like conflict. Most people don't want to be on bad terms with their neighbors. Most people don't want conflict in their life. And the solution to these problems is to understand conflict resolution techniques that are, you know, that are functional, rather than just the minute you have a conflict with your neighbor, will you go run to the board? I have a friend in a condominium down in South Florida who was complaining to me that her manager of her building was unwilling to handle a personal disagreement between her and her upstairs neighbor. And it was like a noise complaint or something. She's like, we have the worst manager in our building. I told her my upstairs neighbor is doing something. And it was something, it wasn't even something that she couldn't have dealt with. I don't even remember the exact thing, but the manager is awful. She won't, you know, we hate our neighbor, so we don't, this is what she told me. We hate our neighbor and we don't talk to them. And we have this problem, but the manager won't deal with it. Now am I supposed to deal with it because I hate them and I won't talk to them? Well, you know, I said to her, I said, that is not your manager's problem. You know, I can appreciate that this is an issue for you, but that is not the condo's issue. This is your issue. You know, be a good person. Get some chutzpah, some cojones, and go to your neighbor and say, hey, I know we've had some disagreements in the past. I wanted to, you know, settle things out. And you know, there's people don't want to fight. Now, there is the other thing Harry mentioned in his article is that there's a certain percentage that are aggressive and are angry people and do want to fight. That's true. And some of those people you can't do anything about. I have a gentleman, another story, a gentleman in my condominium. Big, when I say big, I mean maybe 270 pounds, big, broad, 6'5" Russian guy. Talks aggressive, slams things. He had a disagreement with our building, and our building guests are required to sign in for security purposes. This, to him, was totally anathematic. The whole concept that his guests would have to sign a piece of paper. He wrote a diatribe to the board. I was in communist Russia, and they made us carry papers everywhere. Why should my guests have to sign in? This is awful. I'm not doing this. I won't stand for it. When the front desk person asked his guest to sign in, wouldn't let her in, he came downstairs. He swiped all the things off the desk. He was screaming and yelling and getting violent. Okay, pretty aggressive. But I kind of knew the guy. I had conversed with him a little bit. So what I decided to do is say to him, look, I can tell that you have concerns that are legitimate. I want us to talk about them and see if we can find a solution that is not only appropriate to your concerns, but that takes into consideration the concerns of the association, which are also legitimate. And I set up a meeting with him. And he was very well behaved at the meeting. He apologized to me at the meeting. He said, look, when I get angry, I get very worked up and very heated, and I tend to yell, I would never hurt anyone or do anything violent, but this is a very serious issue to me. And I agreed with him. I said, well, I appreciate your serious issue. Here's our serious issue as a condominium. We need to know who's coming in and out of the building. We had, in the 3.5 years of my condominium, we've had 2 cars stolen, both of them Bentleys, both each of them worth $250,000 apiece. And we had a double homicide, which was it was nothing we could have done anything about. It was a domestic violence issue, tragic and terrible. A man killed his wife and her adult son in a fit of rage when she tried to throw him out of the house. But the fact that those things occurred did bring up security issues, and we wanted to know who our guests were coming into the building. And he understood that concern, too, and we worked out a compromise. Essentially, the compromise we came up with, which is what we use in our building today, is if you don't want your guests to sign in when they come into the building, you come downstairs and you escort them up to their unit personally. It's that simple. If you don't want them to sign in, that's fine, because we recognize you could drive guests into the parking garage yourself and go up to your unit through the elevators, and the front desk would never have any idea who those people are. So it's not like this is a dramatically different situation, but so that was the compromise. And the reason the compromise came to be was because I recognized that most people don't really want conflict. I recognize that even if people are angry and violent and aggressive, that doesn't really mean necessarily that they're violent and aggressive people. I accepted that he had concerns that, whether or not I agree with the concerns, they're his concerns. You're allowed to have concerns in life. Anyone who comes to you is allowed to have concerns in life. And I explained to him our legitimate concerns and explained them in a way that he understood them. And that's conflict resolution, and that's part of being a good neighbor and a good board member in the modern SOC world. I think at that point, I'm going to turn it back over to my father. He's going to tell you a couple of funny stories. One of them I was flabbergasted by. And then both of us will answer questions and chat and hang out. Do whatever you guys want.
Just a couple more, and then we'll answer your questions.
You know, Ryan, when I was growing up, being a good neighbor wasn't loaning the lawnmower, it was getting it back. And Harry, about that article, you mentioned that 95% don't like conflict. You know, it's like a survey I once read that said 95% of people who live in shared ownership communities are happy. The other 5% were members of the boards of directors. I just want to share with you a couple real quick covenants and then answer your questions. And I don't make this up. There's a gentleman in Jasper County, South Carolina, who bought 1,700 acres to build a planned development called the Delta Plantation. Now, his name is Henry Ingram, and this is one of those guys who just never forgives and never forgets. And he writes into his covenants that everyone is welcome here with one exception. He says, I don't want any Yankees living in my community. And he wasn't talking about the baseball team. And he goes on in these covenants to define the term Yankee as any person or entity that was born, lived for more than 1 year, or was created north of the Mason-Dixon line. Now, you think that that would be enough. But old Henry, he also didn't like people whose last name was Sherman. You see, he seemed to recall that there was this northern general who marched through the South and did a lot of damage, and so he also wrote in these covenants, which, by the way, this covenant still exists in that community, that if you're a Yankee and you also happen to have the last name of Sherman, well, this isn't the right plan development for you. And one other story, which is true, you know, you're talking about noisy neighbors. And the sort of interesting story about this story is I just watched a similar thing on the news last night in South Dade. There seems to be a community, a woman who lives in a condominium in which there is 80 bats living in her walls. And she was told that she cannot do anything about it because they're protected. And they recently had their siblings, whatever they call bat siblings, and or babies, and that she has to wait until the breeding period is over with before they can bring out the wildlife crew to remove them. And she's wanted to know what would be the consequences because she couldn't stand even the sight of them flying around and the noises they were making. And they told her it's $345 per bat fine if you were to injure these animals. Now, I was just watching the news in South Florida, and they're having the same problem with the Spanish tile roof in different parts of the state. You know how the roofs are, they have like these openings underneath. And they're curved. And the bats are living inside of these roofing structures. And they said there's really nothing they can do about it because there are literally tens of thousands of them. And if they were to close off one house, all they do is move into the neighboring house. So if you're complaining and you think you're having a problem, just think about these share owners who are now having to live with bats in their units. I did promise you, and I do want to read the one letter that I received from the gentleman about the parrot. This is a for real Levitt letter. He writes, "Our condominium does not allow pets. Since becoming the board president, this gentleman has bought a parrot, which he brings outside on his patio early in the morning, and has awoken me several times before 8 a.m. He tells me that he needs a parrot as a service animal for his injured hand. He has lived here for about 3 to 4 years now and had prior to the parrot a cockatiel. And he goes on to write, the cockatiel made a lovely sound. I never said a word, but this parrot is interfering with the peaceful enjoyment of my unit. It squawks so loudly that I have to turn my TV way up to hear it. I've asked him to please keep the bird inside so as not to disturb me, but he's refused. Doesn't he need to show me a doctor's letter to prove this parrot is a trained service animal? Well, I'll end with I know I've probably overdone it, but in terms of the story, but in the book, I always love to, for the benefit of the board members, the ode to the board. And so for one final time today, let me give you the ode to the board. Some of you serve on your boards. Do we have board members or here? Good for you. Good for you for volunteering and for helping out, as Ryan said, in a civic manner. And the ode to the board goes something like this. A man knocked at the heavenly gate. He stood where people have to wait for admission to the fold. And what have you done, the good Lord asked, to gain admission here? I've been a condo director, sir. Each day seemed like a year. The pearly gates swung open wide. The angels rang the bell. Come in and get your harp, he said. You've had your share of hell. Yeah. Now we will take about 15 minutes of questions. Then Ryan and I both will be back at the table for any of you who either have already purchased or might want to purchase new neighborhoods. It doesn't matter whether you bought it here, if you bought it Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or any place else. If you'd like it to be signed while we're here, we're very happy to do so. But we'll take a few minutes of questions before we adjourn to the back. Yes, sir. The question asked is, we just completed the new budget for our, is it a homeowner association or a condominium? For a homeowner association. And someone told them that if they voted to waive the audit, that they could do it 2 out of the 3 years. First of all, one thing that people tend to forget, and I want to mention that first, is that it doesn't matter what the statute says. If your documents require an audit, then you have to perform the audit unless you amend your documents. Okay, does everyone understand that? So there is statutory language in the Condominium Act, and I'd be honest with you, at the moment I forget whether it's also in the Homeowner Association Act, that requires that associations that have a annual revenues in excess of $400,000 have to do an annual audit unless it is waived. And then one of the amendments recently added said, but even if you waive it, you can only waive it for 2 years, so at least once every 3 years you have to do the audit. That, to the best of my recollection, is not part of the Homeowner Association Act. That is part strictly of the Condominium Act. But again, you need to first check your documents, in the case of a homeowner association, your covenants, conditions, or restrictions, your articles and bylaws, to see whether or not they in fact mandate the audit. Because if they do, then it doesn't matter what the statute says. I know I'm repeating myself, but everyone reads the statute, they vote for the waiver, and they're violating the articles that say there shall be an annual audit. So the first thing, read your documents, and if you don't want to do the audit, then waive it there before you then look to the statute.
Are there any board, for some reason, I don't know why, and just recently, I can over here. And it has been really over the years, and then it's become worse, and there's a lot of
Yes, good question, and I'll try to repeat the question. We have is it a condominium or homeowner association? A condominium owner who was delinquent in paying their assessments. The board had failed to place a lien on the unit. Was the unit later foreclosed by the bank? They auctioned, but it hasn't been sold yet. And so what the unit owner has been doing is been renting the unit and keeping the rent and is not paying the assessments. Did everyone understand? Deal with this 10 hours a day. Let me tell you what's happening. First of all, amend your documents. Very important. To provide that where an owner is delinquent in paying their assessments, the association, if the unit is rented, has a right to attach the rent. Okay? The courts have enforced these provisions. Secondly, in somewhat of a questionable decision, but nevertheless affirmed by the Third District Court of Appeals in the last few months, the court trial judge permitted an association to appoint a receiver to collect the rents. This is happening everywhere. To collect the rents that are being collected by unit owners who are not paying their assessments and to use those rent monies to take out of them the monies that are owed to the association. So the courts are using some extraordinary remedies because they recognize the nature and depth of the problem that I spoke about earlier. But you can help solve this problem by amending your document to provide in your document that you have a right to attach the rents when they're not being paid. Ryan, did you have a comment about
that? Yeah, I just wanted to add.
Can you?
I'll just hold this.
Okay, let me tell you that also. We can do it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to add, similar issue in my own condominium and the way we dealt with it because it might spark another idea. In my association, the documents give us the right to require a standard form of lease from everyone, and a lot of documents have this. Instead of an actual standard form of lease, what we did was a lease addendum, which we require to be signed. And what's written into our lease addendum is the right, if the unit owner is not paying their maintenance, for us to collect the rent directly from the renter. And every rental that comes into our building, that lease has to have this lease addendum attached to it, signed by the owner and the renter. So it is their, you know, it's an enforceable contract between them.
Well, I'm telling you, you can.
There are things, yeah.
Now I have
creativity sometimes.
Yes, and now I'm telling you what the unit owners are doing to circumvent what we're now doing. They're getting their rent paid up front in full for the entire year or two. So you got to be moved quickly in these situations. I mentioned this the last time. Let me tell you some of the things that we're seeing. We're seeing, because there are so many, I'm not talking about hundreds. We're talking about tens of thousands of units that have been abandoned or being foreclosed across the state. In some cases, I'm talking about 20, 30,000 units. Individuals are discovering these empty units. They're having locksmiths change the keys. And they're advertising them on the internet. And they're renting them out weekly, monthly. They're getting their money up front. They're giving the people the keys. And in many associations, particularly those that are where a lot of absentee owners or where they're spread out, where they do not have a central means of gated entrance, they're living there. And we're also finding, in some cases, they're doing a lot of damage to the units. They're stripping the units of the electrical, the appliances, the cabinetry. You really need to be diligent in this time. And the attorney is now telling you there's nothing you can do about it. I'm telling you what is now being allowed to be done, and it's working. Okay? Right. Yeah, what they requires is you first have to sign to qualify to run, and then you have to sign, you know, to serve. And it's been interpreted to say, well, you at least have to sign if you're elected to the board. And if you don't sign, then the individual cannot serve on the board. Now, I'm trying to, we had a law that was written to change that. And it passed the House, and it passed the Senate, and the law was vetoed by the governor. It wasn't vetoed because of that provision. And I did write a strong letter to the governor as to the veto. He vetoed it because also in that bill was a provision that said that the associations that are 75 feet or higher have to retrofit for fire sprinkler system by the year, I think it's 2014. And he was persuaded by the lobbyists for the fire marshals to veto the bill because of that provision. We weren't trying to eliminate the retrofitting of buildings. We were trying to move the date to 2025 because of the current financial crisis. But in the bill that passed, it said that you don't have to certify that you've read the entirety of the Condominium Act. All you have to do is certify that you've read your condominium documents. And you only have to certify that after you're elected to the board. I would say there's a 99% certainty that that law will be repassed this year. It's already been introduced. And hopefully this time the governor will not veto it. Hopefully it will not include the language involving the fire sprinkler system. One or two, yes. I'll try to get you.
I know you're running out of time. My name is Joe Scott, and I was going to find the names of Merritt Ivers. And I'd like to just offer some comments and then ask for your opinion if I could.
Sure.
I bought a condo about 2 years ago. One of the perceptions that I've got in buying a condo is that it's viewed as not a house. It's a townhouse or a condo. It seems to not have the same impact and rule of law.
You get that feeling that you're not dealing the same way you did when you owned a home. You look around the room here and you see people that have been forged by war, raised families, are now retired, and we're all trying to stay within the law, yet when you talk to legislators, and I talk to Steve Cristofoli, who is in this area, and I asked, he must be inundated by people like me talking about HOAs. He said, Joe, you're the first guy that's come into my office. So I said, what do we do? And he talked about awareness, and I brought up picketing banks and legislative offices, which immediately raises a terrible red flag. But at Island Point, we're considering that. We'd like to start picketing the banks you talked about, saying pay your HOA fees and legislative offices. This, in turn, will get us the awareness on television because they're very hungry for news. Anything will get them in front of us. So I'm wondering why this organization of good people have, having expanded all your resources on laws and writing letters, do not want to try some, I don't want to call it civil disobedience, but I want to call it the rights of us, have the same rights as a homeowner, and start picketing banks, picketing legislative offices, and calling television networks. Give me your opinion of that, and will that be viewed as people that are malcontents, or am I going to go back to the hippie days of the 60s again?
No, I there's nothing you just said that I don't 100% agree with. I totally agree with you. A number of years ago, one of the questions asked to me by Roger is when were we all going back to Tallahassee?
A few years ago, we actually chartered an airplane, and we had several hundred condominium and homeowner association leaders and owners go to Tallahassee and spoke to the legislators about the needs for legislation, responsible legislation, in the fields that we've been talking about. You absolutely need to do what you're talking about. I was just up in New Jersey in a community of some 10,000 units where the banks voluntarily, even though they were not legally required because they're not taking title, are contributing the share of the common expenses for units that they're foreclosing because they recognize it's, that it's in their best interest that the community maintain itself in order for their collateral to maintain its value. So I think it's important that you educate your legislators, that you educate the lenders of the importance, and also your owners. I totally concur with what you're suggesting, which is why I just sent my email to the people I just sent it to. Hopefully I'll get a response. I have to tell you that I once before wrote a letter to our congressional delegation about this problem. And the response I got from the legislator's office was, thank you for sharing your concerns of Medicare Advantage. That was the response.
And we thank you for what you're doing also.
Okay, I saw another. Harry, wait a minute. Harry, did you have something?
We're very active in that.
Yeah. Yeah, the Space Coast has always been involved in this process, and as Harry is saying, they actually had two busloads of individuals that drove up here from here to Tallahassee, and I suggest that you may want to organize it again this year because it's something that really needs to be done.
And also, just to point out, a lot of it is marketing. Wear bright red T-shirts that say something like, you know, give us back our HOA rights or whatever it would be. I mean, it really is a marketing issue. You want to be walking around and have the legislators thinking, who are all of these voters? Which is what they're thinking.
So Secretary Budakoff plan to organize something like that again?
Well, we're certainly something we're talking about. We're already working on the legislation. And I have a, I'm on a panel in a few weeks being sponsored by the Sun Sentinel. By the way, that's something that you might want to have your Florida Today and some of the other papers do in your regions. The Sun Sentinel down in Broward County is hosting a workshop for condominium and homeowners to talk about the issues of concerns that they have. And they've invited an array of people to speak, and I'm one of the persons that will be speaking on the panel along with several state representatives.
This question is about the Florida Sunshine Law, and could you go a little further than you know in your book about how much a director of the HOA can speak to other directors, staying in their homes, they're just trying to find solutions to problems that are in the community.
Yep. Do you want me to? Yep. I can talk to this a little bit. It's, you know, as we explained in the book, what the laws that really are being enforced are laws that are either part of 718 or part of 720. It's actually quite simple. You can talk to a non-quorum of your board anytime you want. So if you have a board of five people, two of you can get together and chat about any issue, including any issue in the association. If you have a board of nine people, four people can get together for dinner and talk about any issue in the association. The minute that you go over that number and you have a quorum talking about association issues that are not exempted in the Act, that are not essentially issues of law, it is a technical violation of the Act. What does this include? It includes things like emails. If you send out, and I'm not saying that everyone follows this. I mean, I know huge numbers of board members at other condos and other HOAs that do not bother to follow these rules. I do in my association, and I insist upon them, but a lot don't. If you send out an email to all of your board members saying, can you guys approve so-and-so's salary, and they all send back an email saying, yes, I approve, that's an illegally held board meeting. Even though it's by email, even though they're individual emails going out. What I usually do, if I need to communicate with my board members individually, and again, it's a question, you talk about creative solutions to these problems. There's a lot of them. One of the ways is to send out individual emails. So let's say you have five board members and you need to sort of poll them on their opinion on something, not to make a decision, but you just want to figure something out. Send the emails individually so that when they respond to you, they're only responding to you. Then it's just individual conversations with individual board members. Another thing, you talk about the committees under the laws and a lot of documents. Committees, or at least under my documents, committees have to be open, just like board meetings, committee meetings. So we have committees of one person. There's a committee of one person. Now, why would you even bother doing that? Well, you need the help. You need an extra person to be the person in charge of grounds issues. So we just make them our grounds committee, and they're the only member of the grounds committee. So when they need to deal with issues, they just deal with them, and they don't have to have an open meeting. And again, these are like, you know, getting around it. The truth of the matter is, the way I feel about this, the reason that the rules are there in the first place is to ensure that everybody in the association not only knows what's going on, but has the ability to contribute thoughts on those issues before the board makes a decision. And I have found on a lot of occasions that even though I came into a meeting thinking, all right, I know how I'm going to vote on this, I know the correct way to deal with this, someone in another walk of life who comes to the meeting, who has another job, another career, something else, comes up with an idea that I didn't think of, and it changes my opinion on it. So there is a very legitimate reason why these board meetings are supposed to be open. They want to make sure in a democratic sub-community, which is what they are, that people have the ability to at least share their opinions. And a good board president or whoever is managing the meeting is going to keep those things civil, is going to limit the amount of time involved, is not going to let people spout off forever. But to me, as a board president, I never felt there was any harm in letting even someone who is a malcontent. I mean, I have allowed people in my board meetings stand up and do nothing but spend 2 minutes saying of how bad job the board is doing. And when they're done doing that, I look at them and I say, thank you very much for your comments. That's it. I don't argue with them. I don't start issues with them. I just say, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. And we move on.
Just for clarification, wearing another hat, I serve as a city attorney. So the government in the sunshine is actually a law that deals with collegial bodies of elected officials. The Sunshine Law doesn't apply to condominium and homeowner associations. Those specific statutory laws which deal with openness of meetings govern them. So even though we use the phrase sunshine, it really isn't the law that governs municipalities. In a government setting, any conversation between two or more individuals about any matter that may reasonably come before the body is precluded from being discussed. But in a homeowner or a condominium setting, it has to be a quorum of the board. Also, even in a government setting, there's nothing that precludes you from sharing your memo or thoughts with other members, even the elected officials. What becomes a violation is if they respond in the case of government. And if they respond as a group through a web meeting, that would be a violation. But as Ryan said, if you're doing it one-on-one, it's not a violation. So there are means of communicating, and it's much more open in a shared ownership community than it would be in a government.
When I created a standard with issues that I see, I will often have a point for the membership, but for the board members, I'll describe what I want to do, what my goals are, so they're not taken by surprise by what they see. But I don't solicit any input.
And that's perfectly legal.
And I do the same thing.
By the way, that's perfectly, did you hear that? That's perfectly legal for you to express your opinions and your ideas and share them with other board members. If they respond one-on-one to you, that's perfectly legal in a homeowner or a condo setting. It's only when more than a quorum of the board gets into discussion that it becomes a violation. All right, let's last two questions, and then we'll be at the back room, and you can ask questions as we're...
One quick question. Going back to what your son said about putting an addendum to the lease,
yes.
Our docs do require a lease, a copy of the lease. Do we have to change the documents in order to add an addendum?
If you want to, the answer is no. All your documents currently is saying you need a copy of the lease that's been used. But if you want to have the ability to collect directly the rent from the tenant, you need to amend your documents to give you that authority.
Okay.
And just to clarify, my documents say that we can require a standard form of lease. It is possible that your documents say the same thing.
Yeah.
If they say that the condominium association can specify a standard form of lease, then you can talk to your attorney about including in that standard form of lease a clause that would allow the collection of rents by the association.
Okay. Can we do that retroactively? In other words,
now, you can't do it retroactively to existing leases, but you can do it. You should do it, given the current times, and it would apply to any leases entered into after the effective date.
Okay.
It's something you should do right away. It's very helpful right now. I think I saw one other hand over here.
Talked about the board meetings where people can't say, but how about committee meetings, which are fully advertised? Would anybody who comes to the meeting be able to contribute to, say, a budget meeting?
The laws in condo and homeowner associations are different in this area.
Condo.
I wanted to point that out. I happen to be an advocate for, I just served as the American Bar Association advisor to the Commission on Uniform Laws and dealing with revisions to the Uniform Common Ownership Housing Law. There is a law that governs all shared ownership communities that has been adopted by about half of the states. And I recently advocated for a similar type of law here in Florida because there really is not, it's a distinction without a real difference that we have to stand here and say, well, if it's a condo, it's this, if it's a co-op, it's that, and if it's an HOA, it's totally different. And currently there is nothing in the HOA law that requires meetings of committees to be open to the members the same as it does in a condominium setting. In a condominium setting, committees are treated the same as board meetings unless the documents specifically are amended to exclude certain types of committee meetings, but then there are types that are excluded from the exclusion. For example, budget meetings and meetings that deal with rules and regulations have to be open to the members.
And allow participation.
And allow participation. Interestingly enough, in the homeowner setting, in a condominium, the unit owners are entitled to speak to any agenda item, but in that comes up any matter to discuss, but in a homeowner association setting, theoretically, they're only able to speak to the agenda item. So if something is not published on the agenda and brought up at a homeowner association meeting, it's arguably that the owners don't have a right to speak to it. Personally, I think, and it's the same position I take obviously at municipal meetings, that there should be an opportunity at a meeting for all owners to speak to any item that is being debated and voted on by the board. We thank you for the opportunity to be here. Again, I look forward to seeing you at some later meeting. If any of you who would like us to sign a copy of New Neighborhoods, we'll be in the back of the room for the next 30 minutes or so. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just a quick reminder before you all leave. The next meeting will be October 24th. It'll be on elections and recalls. And the speaker will be Neil McCullough from Clayton and McCullough. And it'll be here at the Comfort Inn. There'll be a board meeting of the board members of Space Coast after the meeting. And we have room for about 6 people if anybody would like to come in. Thank you for your time. Thank you all for coming.